Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Two verses and a chorus shy of a hit song. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino.
And the Music Row Show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Music Row Show. We are glad that you're back with us. Listen to that band play.
Woo!
They love that chord.
Yeah, yeah.
That's D all the way right there.
Look, I just turned down the right one.
Wow. You're so good.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, we'd like to remind you that if you'd like to join in the fun, you can go to Facebook and find us at / The Music Row Show. On Twitter, we're at The Music Row Show. On Instagram, we're Music Row Show.
Oh, I was going to guess.
Go ahead.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Music Row Show.
No, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Pretty cool. Well, why don't we just get to it, Scott? We've got this great, talented guy sitting here in front of us. Let's go ahead and introduce him.
Absolutely. You know, we met Tom, about a year and a half ago, I think, when we had... He came in to perform with Andrea Zahn.
Yes.
And later found out that he's a hit songwriter, producer, guitarist who's written with, for, and performed with pretty much everybody.
Everybody.
Marty Stewart, John Prine, Nancy Griffith, Balsam Ridge, Mack Wiseman, et cetera, et cetera. He's earned 2 CSAC awards, and just last week he was nominated for 4 International Bluegrass Music Awards. He's one of Bluegrass's hottest writers right now, and you think that would be good enough for most people, right?
No, not
Tom. He just released his 2nd solo CD, which is called Crazy If You Let It, just a few days ago here on October 6th, this last Friday, to much critical acclaim, and he was nice enough to come in and visit with us about it. So I'm very excited that you're here, and also, you know, I just did the trip to Germany, and Tom was very kind and reached out and said, hey, let me... Give me some ideas. No. He gave me some ideas and some good places to go, and I appreciate that. It's a pleasure to say, Tom Utes, we're so happy you're here. Welcome to the Music Row Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
Good to be here.
All right. Well, he mentioned Germany. You grew up in Germany.
I did.
And I know you studied flute and piano early on. When did the switch to guitar happen, and what made that happen?
Okay, the switch to guitar happened on October 31st in 1981. There was a TV show in Germany at the time by an old German actor called Freddie Quinn, and the TV show was a country music television show. It was called A Country Time with Freddie Quinn. And I was watching that one day, and Bobby Bear played Detroit City and Pour Me Another Tequila, Sheila. And something in my kid brain snapped, and I knew right there and then that that's what I was going to do with my life. And I walked over to my sister's room, who had a guitar, and I got that guitar and started, you know, just messing around with it. And a couple days later, I could play Detroit City.
Wow.
And found out more about country music, listened to American Forces Network a lot as a kid, and moved here as fast as I could, and became good friends with Bear, and told him that story many times. And I'm not sure if he's flattered about the story or kind of freaked out.
Or creeped out. Yeah.
I'm being stalked. Yeah. Yeah. Whatever happened to that flute? I mean,
still have it.
Yeah.
I can still play. It's like, you know, I started so early. I started when I was 6 years old. It's something that's just in your muscle memory and all of that. So
okay.
I can still do it. Every once in a while when I make a weird pop record or something, I'll bring it out and
do a flute solo or something?
Right now?
No, I mean, you put one on your own. Excellent.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, how often in when you're doing bluegrass
do you hear
production, do you say, you know what this needs?
It needs some flute.
It needs some flute.
And some cowbell.
Not so much in bluegrass, but in singer-songwriter world, every once in a while there's you know, a little thing where you can play it. It's cool to, it's kind of weird, you know, like over 30 years later, it's something that I still know how to do. It's like riding a bicycle.
If you ever start a Jethro Tull cover band, you are ready to go.
I was never a fan.
Yeah,
I'm
me neither. But, you know, but they had the flute.
This segment brought to you by Jethro Tull's greatest hits.
No.
Well, it's interesting to me because if you think about 1981, the music that that we were listening to at that time, for the most part, was not Bobby Bear. You know, it was, you know, 81 was kind of the beginning of the the punk and the new wave type of stuff, if I remember correctly. And, of course, hair bands. And there was all sorts of stuff going on then.
You know, in retrospect, there probably wasn't that much great music in the 80s. But one thing I'll say about 80s music, there were great melodies.
Yeah.
You can listen to anything from Depeche Mode to the Eurythmics, and there's some great melodies in all of this stuff. It was just buried under a lot of weird sounds that people were in love with at that time. Weird keyboard sounds and all of that. As a friend of mine who played a gospel session here in town, at one point said he was playing this gospel session, and as you know, in Christian music, there's very often a lot of heavy keyboard tones and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He walked out of the recording room and he said, "Who knew that God's favorite instrument was the DX7?
All these years later.
But I guess what I find really interesting about that is, given what was on the radio and pop radio and all of that, mm-hmm. For you to be that young and for that to just sink its claws into you, I'm just curious about what was it about the American country that did that to you?
The very first thing that caught my attention was the sound of the pedal steel guitar. It's something mm-hmm. that I had not heard, and I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such an expressive instrument, and I was drawn to that. And I think when you're a child, you don't analyze what fascinates you. You just see something or hear something, and you go in that general direction, and you figure out the particular aspects of that later. And that's what I did, and that's essentially what I did when I moved to Nashville too. Because if you know enough about Nashville to really have a clear idea of what it's all about, you're going to be too scared to make the move.
Right.
So you have to be ill-informed to a certain extent to make decisions like that. And that's what it's like when you're a kid. You know, you hear something, you see something, and you just start walking, and you figure out the rest.
That's a fascinating. I want to stop on this for a minute. As far as needing to be uninformed about the realities of Nashville, why is that?
Well, I mean, I had been here 4 or 5 times before we made the move, and I knew a couple of people, and I had some friends. But even that is not enough to really have an understanding of how competitive this music business is in this town, and how incredibly great people like Travis Meadows and other writers and players are. You have to be here and experience it firsthand, and it intimidates the hell out of you. But it also, you know, once you make the move, there's no going back. I mean, to me, there was never the option of going back, because it would always feel like that would come with a sense of defeat that I don't want to have in my life. I'd rather just keep mm-hmm. plugging at it and do the best that I can. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, you can go to the station in any given night, or you can go hear the Time Jumpers on a Monday night. If you're a guitar player, if that doesn't scare the daylights out of you,
yeah.
I don't know what will.
Or karaoke anywhere in Nashville. You know, you're going to hear some amazing singers.
Right.
You know, so what did your family think when you said, "Hey, see ya, going to Nashville"?
You know, they knew that. I mean, I had made my way, or even when I was living over there, all I ever did was play music, and I went to university for a while and studied classical guitar and all of that.
In Stuttgart, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, I actually auditioned in Trossingen too, which is a place that you just visited.
Right.
There's a conservatory there. So, yeah, I mean, they knew that I was sort of a free spirit and that I was going to do it the way I wanted. I was going to do it, and it was just, there was no doubt in my mind and that I was going to make this move. So there was no holding me back. I'm sure they weren't very happy about it, but now they see certain things that are enjoyable to them. Certain reference points they don't understand, but that's okay.
Like
when I was playing with Mary Gaucher, we were opening 10 days of gigs for Willie Nelson in England and Ireland, and I talked to my mom and said, "We're going to this is really exciting. We're going to open some shows for Willie." And it was just silence on the end, because she doesn't know who Willie Nelson is, and I can't blame her for that.
Huh.
So
did they come to the shows?
No.
Oh.
They come to shows when we play in Holland or Germany, and they really like it. And they're very supportive of all I'm doing.
Of course.
And were they happy when the plane left? Probably not.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you talking about Scott's plane? Because they were probably, you know, jumping up and down.
Yeah, I don't know. So in 2003, you finally get the U.S. visa.
Mm-hmm.
And now, okay, before that, though, you're playing all over Central Europe,
mm-hmm.
in all sorts of different bands.
Mm-hmm.
I read an Elvis cover band.
Well, it wasn't as much an Elvis
tribute band.
I had a 4-piece band that was pretty versatile, so we played with the African American blues and soul singer who was really good. We played with this Elvis impersonator who ironically had the same initials as Elvis. His name was Eric Prinsinger, so he had EP, mm-hmm. and he looked like him a little bit too, and he was a really good singer. What wasn't so good about him was that his English wasn't very good. So he had a horrible time pronouncing a TH. So every time we played In the Ghetto, one line came out as, "The only thing that she don't need is another hungry mouse to feed."
No more mice.
Now, that's poor.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So you get to town in 2003, and before long you're touring with Mary Gaucher.
That's right.
Nancy Griffith. Mm-hmm. How was that as far as a comparison? Was it a whole different world than the performing you were doing in Europe?
Yes.
Talk about that. Why and how?
Well, in Europe, I was sort of the leader of that band, and Europe being Europe and the chemistry being what it is over there, everybody wanted me to be the leader, but nobody accepted me as being the leader. So it was kind of a no-win situation. When I came over here and played for people like that, I didn't have to lead at all. Somebody else was leading, and I was just playing and supporting them and being nice to them and being agreeable and playing as good as I could and giving my input when I was asked and shutting up when I was not asked. And that's a completely different story. And then if you do that for a while, people begin to trust you, they'll want to get your input on making records. And so I ended up producing a record for Nancy and writing with her and being on the road with her for 5 years. And it's a different deal. And traveling in America is a different deal because the distances are so much greater.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, with an international recording artist like Nancy, we toured in Canada, we toured all over Europe, we toured in Australia, we toured here. We were on a bus, we were on planes. That was a level of touring that I had not experienced.
Right.
So it was completely different. It was an incredible experience, incredible learning curve, and you have to learn on the job. You know, I mean, people like Nancy at that time didn't waste a lot of time rehearsing. You had to show up and know the material and do a good job. And mm-hmm. but she was also incredibly great to work for because she just let you do your thing. She didn't want you to play like the guy before.
Right.
It's like, I hired you, so you play. So I want you to play the way you play. You interpret my music the way you want to interpret it. And that was really great.
And so you didn't have to learn lick for lick what was on an album.
Well, you have to learn certain things that are sort of
signature signatures.
Licks. Yeah, but other than that,
she was incredible, and Mary Gaucher as well at letting me just bring my own thing to the table.
That's awesome.
Which not a lot of people do.
No,
but they did.
Speaking of Mary, can I just do a quick...
You do a shout-out. Go ahead.
Mary's going to be here next week.
Next week,
her and Max T. Barnes coming in the first
awesome.
Hour.
Tell her I said, hey.
I'll do it.
Yeah, I was with her for 3 years and recorded with her and traveled with her and after that with Nancy. And then after that, it was time to do my own thing.
Wow. Very cool.
Wow. Well, speaking of Visa, which we just talked a minute ago, how hard was that as a musician trying to make that move? Was it harder or easier because you're a musician, or did it matter at all, or what was that whole process like?
I think it's very difficult for anybody who wants mm-hmm. to come here, unless you work for a big international corporation that can prove that they need you to come here to do a particular job.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that, it's very difficult to get here. So for me, the only option was to play the green card lottery, which the United States give away 50,000 green cards a year. And I played, and the second year that I played, I won. Now, after you win the lottery, you still have to prove that you have X amount of money, that you have a totally clean criminal record, that you're healthy, that you can support yourself and all of that for at least for a while. And so it's a long process, and I think it's good that it's a long and somewhat complicated process, so they make sure that the right people get in.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 5 years, If you've lived here on a green card for 5 consecutive years, you can apply for citizenship, which my wife and I did and became citizens in 2009.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. That's something I don't take for granted, and it's a pretty unique experience to be in a courtroom with 150 people from all over the world, knowing that you're one of the privileged ones who made that who moved here by choice.
Yeah.
Other people moved here because somebody was coming after them with a hatchet somewhere, or from a Civil War-ridden country, or this or that. So, that you know, that gives you a different perspective at that decision. And so that informs to a certain extent what I do musically and what I try to bring to the community and all of that.
That's very awesome. Yeah. Hey, let's take a break. You know, a few weeks ago, we were at the Smoky Mountain Songwriters Festival in Gatlinburg. Instead of staying in Gatlinburg, which is so much fun, but it's also very, very crowded and lots of hustle and bustle.
A lot of people love Gatlinburg. So
a lot of people love Gatlinburg, which is good, and we want them to love Gatlinburg. But we decided to go to Townsend.
We did. It was awesome.
We got some cabins, and it's just a quiet part of this. It's called the peaceful side of the Smokies, right?
And it was. And we went through our friends over at Dogwood Cabins. They hooked us up with a couple of great cabins, you with your family and me with my buddy over there. And we had a great time. It was and beautiful. The cabins were well appointed, and it was just awesome. Loved it. If you're going to go to Gatlinburg, check out dogwoodcabins.com because they have some great cabins, and it's really a great deal, too.
Absolutely. Hey, we're going to be back with more of Tom Utes right here on the Music Row Show. Stick around. We'll be right back.
I'm crossing over Black Mountain. I can almost see it home on mine. I'm crossing over Black Mountain for the very last time. It's a long way to go from Kentucky. Through the hills of Tennessee, just a few more days if I'm lucky, and I'll hope one who means the world to me. I'm crossing over Black Mountain.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's Tom Utes doing Crossover. Crossing over Black Mountain. I love that.
Well, you
would never in a million years say, oh, that guy's from Germany, listening to that. You can't even tell.
Well, can I add to that?
Yeah.
Because I was performing last week with a bunch of German bands, and they were singing a lot of Johnny Cash, but there was definitely, they all sounded very German. And to that, I mean, writing a hit song is an amazing accomplishment. But writing hit songs in a language that's different from your native language, I think, is pretty extraordinary. Because most language courses aren't big on nuance and slang, right? So how did you teach yourself?
Well, first of all, the type of school that I went to in Germany, you have to start taking English lessons in grade 5. Mm-hmm. And school lasted through grade 13. So I had the last 2 years were like, English was like one of my main focuses. And I had a really great teacher who was a Irish origin fellow from Boston who had married a German lady and who was big into music and sort of instilled a sort of a desire in me to read American literature, Hemingway and stuff like that. And then at the same around the same time, I got to know my then girlfriend, now wife, Eva, who had just come back from living in the States for 5 years. So she was fluent and accent free in English, and she brought a different musical taste with her. So that was an education. Plus, I grew up in an area where the two largest Canadian air bases were really close to where I grew up. So when I was about 15, 16, I started playing in bands with Canadian soldiers. And they brought me on bass and bought me a guitar at one time. They bought me cigarettes. They bought me what they called killer Heinies, which were Heineken tall boys. And I started playing with them. And so that was more an introduction sort of through the back door into Northern American culture. So I was always, it was not just the love for American music, but also that I had, you know, sort of gotten to know and fallen in love with those kind of people. And then my wife and I started traveling to the States and to Canada when we were in our early to mid 20s. And at that point, I had befriended, like I said, the blues and soul guy from North Carolina who had lived over there. I toured with a Texas songwriter called Richard Dobson, who was good friends with Guy Clark and Hans Van Zandt when they came to town, who had married a Swiss lady. And so I was always really, really supremely fascinated with this, with Southern culture, Southern literature, Southern music. So that helps. If you just come here and you hate all that stuff, it's probably a little more difficult to write bluegrass songs. But you also
yeah,
I can imagine.
But I think you have to also just keep your ear close to the ground and listen and pay attention to what the people around you are saying. And but again, I think it comes down to following your original fascination with something. When I had listened to bluegrass music pretty much all my life, but when I got here and I fell in with some people who are like bona fide bluegrass people who grew up in East Tennessee and Western North Carolina or Eastern Kentucky, I started paying really close attention to how they talked about this music, who they listened to, how they perceived that music, what the sense of timing is that they're paying attention to. And, you know, I still do that. I think sometimes it can be an asset if you come from a different place, because things mean something different to you. Like when you come over here from Germany, it means that if you're just driving from Memphis to East Tennessee, you're going to look at that stretch of I-40 in a different way than somebody who grew up here. Just like you probably viewed Germany, or you know, looked at Germany very differently than I would if I go.
Sure,
back.
Sure. I was looking at all these details and going, wow, and you'd be like, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, you know, I've been gone long enough now to where I go back, I experience it completely differently again. It's like coming to it through the back door and going like, I didn't remember this. You know, this is different, or this is really annoying me, or this is really nice and I can relate to this. I mean, it's just, but you know, I think you just got to trust your instincts, and then I don't think that anything in the music business particularly is linear. You just start walking in a general direction and then you figure out the rest, you figure it out, or it'll be figured out for you.
So did you ever have to run lyrics by anybody, just say, hey, am I saying this right? Or
no, I don't think so. I mean, I co-write a lot, so that's sort of built in.
Right.
I feel confident that I don't have to do that.
Okay, good.
So
once again, the CD is Crazy If You Let It by Tom Utz, and Utz is spelled J-U-T-Z.
Yeah,
Tom,
and to make it more complicated, Tom is spelled T-H-O-M-M, which is a drastic mistake that I made in my early 20s, but it's something I'm stuck with now.
Mm-hmm. I like it, but we'd love it. You got your guitar right there. We'd love to hear a song from you.
Yeah, this is a title song from Crazy If You Let It, and it's a song that I wrote with my friend Andre Azan, who's one of the greatest humans and musicians that I know, and I also the other co-writer on this is a fellow called Bill Lloyd, who's been in Nashville for a long time.
Oh yeah,
and all right, here it is, called Crazy If You Let It. Lapping at the edges of the life I live, all those memories filling up my mind, makes you careful with a heart you long to give. We're lonely people in a lonesome time, but you find a way to rise up to another day. You wear a smile and for a while forget it. Shake it off, take the loss, let it float away. 'Cause it can drive you crazy if you let it. Counting down the reasons to be blind with fear, as if it even matters anymore. Makes you wonder what it is you're doing here, and what it is that you've been waiting for. But you find a way to rise up to another day. You wear a smile and for a while forget it. Shake it off, take the loss, let it float away. 'Cause it can drive you crazy if you let it. And there is so much beauty to this world we're born. For every dark night there waits another morning.
you find a way to rise up to another day. You wear a smile and for a while forget it. Shake it off, take the loss, let it float away. 'Cause it'll drive you crazy if you let it. Yeah, it can drive you crazy if you let it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so pretty.
Well, thank you.
Well done.
That a lot, yeah.
I'm curious because we mentioned when we were introducing you, you do an awful lot of producing,
mm-hmm.
and you're writing on a lot of other projects. Given how busy you are, what motivated the decision to record a new project, Crazy If You Let It?
Yeah, well, two things. I was very fortunate over the last couple of years to get a bunch of cuts in bluegrass music, and it just felt like it was a good time to follow up on that with making a record that, and I mostly work out of my own studio, so I can do whatever I want to do, and I don't have to plan much for it, and can just walk over there and do it. So it just felt like a good time to do this, to have like a sonic business card, if you want to, so people can see the breadth of my writing. I think there's a good variety of bluegrass related material on that, not just straight bluegrass, but also just what I consider acoustic music. Plus, I have the people that play on this record are some of my closest friends and some of my favorite people in the world, and certainly my favorite musicians. It's a guy you mentioned, Mark Fain, is playing bass, and mm-hmm. Sierra Hall, who's an incredible mandolin player. She's 26 years old and just won Mandolin Player of the Year for the second year in a row, and her husband, Justin Moses, who plays banjo, fiddle, mandolin, dobro. And so, you know, when those guys come over and you record, that doesn't feel like work. It feels like it's just fun, and it's exciting and inspiring. And so why would I not want to do something like that? You know, it's just great fun. Plus, it's, you know, if nothing else, I can pitch those songs to other people. But the other thing that happened was I produced a record last year with my friend Peter Cooper on a gentleman called Mag Wiseman, who's one of the true legends of American folk music, bluegrass music.
All-time greats.
Absolutely. He's 92 years old. And Peter and I had gotten to know him over the making of another record. And he told us a lot of stories about growing up in rural Virginia during the Great Depression. And we kept notes of those stories. And we came back to him and said, Mac, how would you feel if we wrote these stories into songs with you? And he was very excited about that idea. So Peter and I went over there for 9 or 10 Sunday afternoons in a row, and Mac doesn't get around well anymore,
right.
But his memory and his mind are still incredibly sharp. So we fed those stories back to him, and he elaborated on those stories, and we turned them into songs. And then we decided, well, let's turn this into a record, but because Mac doesn't get around so well anymore, we decided, we asked him, how would you feel if we turned this into a tribute record to you? And we will ask some of your and some of our favorite bluegrass singers to come in and sing these songs about your life. And he was very excited about that. So we started making plans and called some folks that we liked, like John Prine and Alison Krauss and Sean Kemp and Junior Sisk and Jim Lauderdale and Sarah Hall and a bunch of others, the Isaacs. And they were all excited to come in and pay tribute to one of their heroes.
Right.
So then we needed to find a partner to put this out. And I had a couple of songs recorded by an artist who was on this label called Mountain Fever out of Willis, Virginia. And I met the founder and owner of that company, Mark Hodges, at a concert at the Station Inn. And I said, man, I have this idea. Can I maybe call you next week and run this idea by you? And he was like, absolutely, call me. So Peter and I called him, laid out the idea, told him how much it was going to cost. And the whole conversation took about 15 minutes, and we had a deal that we were going to do it.
Wow.
And so this record was fairly successful, I think. It got a lot of great reviews. It was nominated for a couple things at the IBMA convention this year. And Mark, the owner of Mountain Fever, and I became really good friends over the making of this record. And he says we're family now, which is the way I feel about him too. So when I had when I planned to make this record, I didn't want him to feel obliged to put this out, but I also didn't want to miss the opportunity to put it out on a good label that is that works very effectively. So I just called him and said, "Man, I'm going to make a record. Please don't feel like you have to put this out, but I just wanted to let you know." And he was like, "No, man, we want to do it. Your family, let's do this." So here I am at 48 years old with my first deal on a bluegrass label, or any label for that matter, and I'm just, you know, trying to do all I can to do right by them and promote this and get it out and make sure that people hear it and that it's good for them and as good for them as it is for me.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
So Mountain Fever Records. Now, the album he's talking about with Mac Wiseman is called I Sang the Song, Life of the Voice with the Heart. Mac Wiseman, I Sang the Song. And then, of course, his album is Crazy If You Let It by Tom, T-H-O-M-M, Utes, J-U-T-Z, tomutes.com. Let's take a break.
Let's do that.
We should mention that this segment is brought to you by our friend Barbara.
Barbara Potter Photography.
Barbara Potter Photography.
Actually, that's not hacked. Barbara Potter is her name. Her company is Barbara Potter Photography. And she's a great photographer.
She really is.
I mean, she's done some great stuff for you. She's done some... I've seen so many of her pictures, and just she really captures people's...
Because we like know these
inner,
people.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you see pictures of... Sometimes you see pictures of somebody that you know that were professionally taken, and you're like, that doesn't really look like them, you know? It's like,
or
I know that guy, and that doesn't really look like him, you know?
Yeah.
But hers, she captures, like, the good parts of you. I mean, it looks like the people... But they look cool, too,
yeah.
You know? So it's like... I don't even know how to put it into words. It's just magic. I mean, she just does a great job.
You just put it into words beautifully. Now, Barbara is going to be in town in November. She does. She goes back and forth between a couple places. So if you'd like to book her, this is a great time to get a hold of her on Facebook at Barbara Potter Photography. We're going to be back with more of Tom Utes. You're listening to The Music Row Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show. We're here with Tom Utes, and that's Lily of the Day off of his brand new album called Crazy If You Let It, which is awesome. So when you got into the production side of things, did you already know, like, all the, you know, the gear, the technical side of it, or did you have to learn that as you went along as well?
Well, I had a studio back in Germany with a friend of mine, and I had always... been messing with recording gear since I was 14, 15 years old.
So you knew all that stuff, yeah.
Well, I don't know if you ever know all of it, but you know whatever you need to know to do what you need to do, and then you learn more as you go along. I mean,
right.
At the moment I'm working on a record for a lady of Indian descent who's living in Switzerland, and she's making a record here in Nashville, and it's a pretty pop, you know, kind of affair, and we're recording at Blackbird, which is a great studio.
Yeah,
and I'm just keeping my eyes and ears open and learn something from those engineers over there. And there's plenty to learn. You know, you never stop learning unless you make a decision to stop learning.
That's true. That's true.
That's so brilliant. I would like to hear another song, though.
I would too.
I would too.
You think he'll do it?
And I think he's going to do one off the Mac Wiseman.
You think he will?
This is one of the songs from the Mac Wiseman record. This is the title song called "I Sang the Song," and on the record, John Prine is singing this song, and this is a tune that's written from the perspective of Mac looking back at his life. He's 92 years old now, and it's an American life that nobody's going to live like that anymore. And all these all the lines in this songs are things that Mac said. We didn't add anything. We just shuffled the lines around and made him rhyme. And he's in the song, he mentions some of the people that he worked with when he was doing radio in Bristol. He was on a show called the Farm and Funtime Show, and people like A.P. Carter, who was, you know, founder of the Carter family, came and did a weekly segment on his radio show. And A.P. Carter was selling pocket testaments on live on the radio, and Mac was selling Baby Chicks and Ladies' Hose on the radio. And he's just a really incredible guy. And so this is Mac looking back at his life. It's called I Sang the Song. I could hear the highway calling long before the road ran through. Dreams are free, not much else is. What else can a poor boy do? Calais, France, the cliffs of Dover. Name a city, I've been there. Women laughing, babies crying. Sound the same most anywhere. Baptized in the old South River. Three times forward, I've been blessed. Just another young hillbilly. Who would have thought? Who could have guessed? Gordon Lightfoot, A.P. Carter, Mother Mabel, June and John. It ain't bragging if you've done it. Name the tune, I sang the song. And now I'm old, no way to hide. I wouldn't care to truth be told. Once a man and twice a child. But I've got a hand to hold. And I could hear the highway call long before the road ran through. Dreams are free, not much else is. What else can a poor boy do? Dreams are free, not much else is. What else can a poor boy do?
Yeah, man. Wow. I love that.
Thank you.
I love that. Whew.
Well, that's the story of Mac Wiseman.
That was so good.
You know what? We just might as well take a break right there.
Let's do that. And guess what? Brought to you by our buddy, Buddy Hyatt.
BuddyHyatt.com. Greatest producers in town, whether you need a demo or a full album project, indie project, whatever it is, he's done it all. I mean, the man's worked with Grammy nominated people all the way down to, you know, songwriters like you and me, and he does a great job for everybody. He's got an amazing stable of musicians that he pulls in for your projects, mm-hmm. and I mean, some of the biggest names around that you see on albums, you see their credits on albums that you most certainly have in your collection.
I can find some of them on Tom Utz's
that is
CD
true.
That has been working on songs that I've written. So how cool is that?
That is awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. You can find them at BuddyHyatt.com.
Yep.
And we're going to be back in just a few minutes with a whole lot more of Tom Utz on the Music Row Show.
Left the cardboard box about a half mile down the road.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. That is a song called The Guitar. That's off of the Mac Wiseman tribute album. What's the official? It's called I Sang the Song.
That's right.
And who was that singing?
That was Sierra Hull and her husband Justin Moses singing.
Wow, I like that.
It's a story about Mac's first guitar.
All right, I love that. Mm-hmm. So you've gotten to work with a lot of your musical heroes along the way so far.
Yeah.
Who are some of your other musical heroes that you've gotten to work with that you're like pinching yourself thinking, I can't believe I'm doing this?
Well, certainly Mac Wiseman. Certainly working with John Prine, who sang a song on this record, and having him come in and sing one of the songs that I wrote with Peter and Mac. That's something that doesn't happen very often as a songwriter. And Alison Krauss came in, and I'm a huge Alison fan, and that was something that was important to me. I'm working with Whispering Bill Anderson on something right now, and have made a record with him last year that's sort of a companion piece to the audio version of his autobiography. And Bill is a hero of mine and such an inspiration. At 80 years old, he works every day. He's fascinated with what he's doing as he was when he started out. He's interested in anything and everything that goes on in our house, and just a wonderful addition to our life to have him as somebody to work with. And so,
and by the way, his book is amazing.
Oh,
that is just a great read.
It's a wonderful book. I think it's the only book that really takes a close look at the co-writing culture of Nashville and explains it in a really, really fascinating way. So, you know, he goes into how he wrote Whiskey Lullaby with John Randall, and he's just a super, super great guy.
Yeah. So. Now, speaking of songwriting, you do some instructing over at Belmont.
Well, yes,
I still am.
I started as a mentor 2 years ago, meaning that students in their senior year get together with me if they want to, and it's usually typically one or two students per semester, get together with me once a week for an hour, and they can ask me whatever they want or ask my help with whatever they need help with. It might be guitar-related stuff. It might be co-writing. It might be recording stuff. It might be critiquing songs. It might be critiquing mixes, whatever they think they need help with. And this year, this semester is the first semester that I'm actually teaching one class. So I'm teaching one class a week, which is exciting, you know, to be in a room with young people that are that talented and dedicated to their to developing their craft and all of that.
Well, when it comes to the craft, in your opinion, what is it that can be taught and what is it that can't be taught?
Well, one of the other adjunct professors over there is a guy called Pat Elcher, who's one of the greatest writers who ever came to this town. And Pat puts it in a great way. Pat says, we can't teach you songwriting, but we can help you to become a better songwriter.
Right.
And that's pretty much what we try to do. And it's and we are very clear with the students that this is an incredibly competitive environment here. And we make sure that they understand that. And we make sure that they understand that they have to bring their A game all the time or it's not going to happen. But in terms of how much is it teachable, I don't know. I think you can teach somebody a lot of technique. You can teach somebody to pay attention to certain reference points to make them understand why a song like Good Old Boys Like Me is as great as it is. You can teach them why The Randall Knife by Guy Clark is one of the greatest songs ever written. You can lead them to stuff like that and maybe hopefully make them feel that you're really fascinated with this stuff, and maybe that leads them to taking another look at that. And then there's just like you can practice the guitar, you can practice writing too.
Yeah.
You just and there are certain techniques that you can that you can teach them, and you can it's a very open process. We just encourage them to have a conversation between them, and it's not a top down here we feed you a bunch of information and you need to soak that up and spit it out again. It's more inclusive than that. It's a really, really fascinating program. It's a lot of fun to be involved in it.
Do you ever have occasion to go and teach back in Germany?
I was over there last year to play a bluegrass festival, and they organized a songwriting workshop, and I did that. And that's a little trickier because...
I was going to say, how do you approach that differently?
I don't really know. I don't have it conceptualized. I think what I did was I just had people play something that they had written, and then I said, well, maybe you could look at this, or maybe you wouldn't say it like this, or stuff like that. You have to take a little bit of a different approach. I mean, the people who are applying to study songwriting at Belmont are people who have already written a bunch. They're not people who just have written one song. Mm-hmm. They have to apply with videos and recordings and all of that. And it's pretty heavily, it's very selective on mm-hmm. who gets in. So actually, it would be a lot more challenging to teach something like that back in Germany than it is here. You know, but for several, I don't know necessarily why that is, but it would be.
Were the people that you were mentoring in Germany, were they doing songs in German or in English? Or
no, in English.
Okay.
And that's a big part of it, or would be a big part of it if you do it over there. It'd be more like an English class.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not an English teacher.
Okay.
You perform quite a bit with Peter Cooper, who you produced the Mac Wiseman yeah. project with, and also Eric Brace. Mm-hmm. Peter's been on the show. We've not had Eric on, but mm-hmm. how did you guys find each other, and what makes you guys so... you know, certain people just are super compatible on stage, and you guys are. So how does that work out?
I think it's because we're all a little over 6 feet tall.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, I'm sure that's it.
Here's how it all came together. I mean, obviously I was aware of Peter's journalistic writing, and we were all hanging out at Folk Alliance when it was still in Memphis 1 year, and Eric has this independent record label called Red Bead Records, and they had a showcase room, and we were hanging out there, and Peter and I were walking back to the hotel, and Peter said, you know, I have a lot of respect for what you do. And I looked back at him and said, well, I have a lot of respect for what you do. And so he called me one day after that and said, like, look, we're doing this thing at Douglas Corner. Would you mind playing with us? And from there, it led to him coming to the studio and recording a couple things. And then we worked together really, really well. And I think it's because we take the work very seriously, but we don't take ourselves overly seriously,
right?
And when we go play, it's turned into a really cool thing. I think we're really, really good at just waltzing into a situation without PA, without anything, and just play. And we do a lot of house concerts for, you know, 50 or 60 people that come to see this kind of music and buy this kind of music, and we do really well with that. And it's a lot of fun. We made a bunch of records together. We just had a new record come out. It's called Profiles in Courage, Frailty and Discomfort, and that was not my idea. That was Peter's idea.
Great title.
Oh, I like it. I like it too. I'm just saying it was not my idea. And yeah, it's good. I mean, we played a bunch this last week. We played like four or five shows, and it's great. And then we might have a month where we don't play at all, and then we have another month where it's really heavy. And so it's not, you know, we're not trying to conquer the world. We're just, you know, doing it because it feels good and because we like to do it.
Right.
Mm. So when you're producing, and especially if you're producing somebody that writes their music as well as record mm-hmm. it, how do you take your songwriter hat off, or how do you approach saying, hey, artist person, we need to change this, or that doesn't work, or...
Well,
I mean,
you know,
can you critique as a producer, or how do you approach that?
It depends on what the nature of the project is. Mm. If it's somebody who comes over, you know, let's say it's somebody from Europe who comes over here to make a record that they want to market in Sweden, I'm not going to get involved and tell him what he can write or what he should change, because it's clearly marketed to a different audience.
Right.
If he's not marketing it over here, there's no sense in me getting involved at that level. I just go like, okay, I'll give you my input on, if you give me 15 songs, which 10 are the best ones and which ones you should record or you shouldn't record, but I'm not going to rewrite these songs with you unless you want that. But then it has to be stuff that I want to be involved in as a writer. If I, you know, if it's stuff that I don't necessarily, that I'm not excited about, then I don't want to be involved as a writer. But, you know, a producer at the level that I'm producing is often more a facilitator. You know, like I book the studio, I book the players, I put it all together, I write the charts, I know how to do it, and you can come, you know, and we'll make a record that's going to be really, really good. Or, you know, as much as you can be objective about recording quality, it's going to be a good recording. And sometimes that's all that's required, you know. And
right.
Sometimes you have to get really into the details of what does this song want, and I don't know. It's different every time. Like I said, at the moment I'm recording with this lady from Switzerland who's of Indian descent, and she's an incredibly good singer. She's got some great songs with pop appeal, and so you try to just get into, put that hat on and get into that and book players that work for that and try to make that as good as you can. You
know? Wow.
It's very different from producing something like the Meg Wiseman record where it's a whole, it's more of a storytelling approach.
Sure. And it's obviously marketed towards people in this country.
Yes.
You know, so I mean, are there some distinct musical differences that you've noticed in stuff that gets produced for this country versus this country? Let's say Sweden, for example.
I don't know. No, I don't. I couldn't say that musically it's very different.
Okay.
I mean, when people come, and it's not like I'm only working with people from Europe, but mm-hmm. you know, a certain amount of people from Europe come over here. They're probably very much look. It's ironic that people that come over here from Europe are probably looking for more traditional sounding country music than people from here.
I see. Yeah.
Unless
yeah.
they're the singer songwriter folky types from over
right,
here.
Right. Right.
But a lot of European people are very, very, you know, still very fascinated with traditional sounding country music and pedal steels and Telecaster and all that. Kind of stuff.
Well, God
all
bless.
Good stuff.
That's
yeah.
awesome.
What I'm
saying. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in
thank
and
you
joining
me.
Us. We oh, love that. Your website.
www.tomutz.com.
Tomutz.com.
TomMMJUTZ.com. You can get the record at mountainfeverrecords.com or on Amazon, iTunes, wherever you want.
Awesome. Love that. Well, it's we've got
great.
Another great show next week. Mary Gauthier is going to be with us.
And Max T. Barnes and Bobby Marquez.
Nice.
It's going to be a party.
It's going to be great. So yeah. join us next week on the Music Row Show. In the meantime, go visit us at our website, themusicrowshow.com. We'll see you next week.